introduce two other ways in which you can interact with Julia. I showed you the command line where I run Julia in a terminal and you have an editor open. There are other ways. I learned last week that some people use Juno and they work quite well for them. Juno is built on the Atom editor and then you installed an additional package and then you have a nice integrated development environment. If you Google for Juno Julia, you'll find install instructions and I'd be happy to help you install it. Of course, not now during the lecture, but at some other point. Finally, there exists a company that offers Julia as a web service. This is called Julia Box, and the initial access is for free. You go to Julia Box and you log in, for example, with your GitHub account. I'm just demonstrating this here, right? I'm not expecting you to follow on. And then you can launch a kernel, and then in your web browser, you see a nice user interface, and you can run Julia there. I mean, you're not getting an expensive workstation there, some dinky virtual machine probably, and I think you can compute for 20 minutes before you cancel your kernel. But if you just want to show something to someone else or experiment with something that should work, and here create a new Julia 1.0 instance. So on Wednesday, it didn't support Julia 1.0 yet. Now they do, which is why I'm actually showing it. And the kernel is starting, and then we can calculate something like 2 plus 3 here. We'll have to wait until the kernel is starting up. This is probably too small. Sorry, let's make it larger. And there, 5, and this runs on their hardware, and they let me run it for free. And the last thing I wanted to show, the last way to run Julia, is called iJulia. That's a JupyterHub notebook, and that looks a bit like Mathematica. And I'm actually going to use that during my lecture today, because I noticed in the last lecture that I'm very easily able to show you some code, but it is very difficult for me to show you things that are not code, to talk about things that I'd like to sketch on a blackboard, etc. And a iJulia notebook allows me to do that. So I hope that gives my lecture a bit of a better structure. This now looks like Julia Box, but this is now actually running on my laptop here. And I can not only write code, I can also write other comments. And I'm going to use that during my lecture here. That's how this works. Software Engineering Lab, which is today's session. And it looks like this. So, having said this, there are three things I want to show today. How does this work? Trying to find out. Do you know the key combination for switching to Markdown in iJulia? You don't? Okay, it's going to be pointy-clicky then. Sorry. I want to discuss three things in today's lecture. First, I want to talk about source control or version control. Second, I want to talk about tests and test cases to ensure that software that is correct at some point remains correct. And third, I want to talk about using professional infrastructure. Professional managed infrastructure. And let's see how that works. Yes, it works beautifully. And the idea is, if you keep all your code, everything on your laptop, you're going to run into some trouble at some point because the laptop might be stolen, might burn down, or you might lose it. You might pour coffee over it. And if you use some professional infrastructure, workstations, then you can run the code there for faster. You can run test cases there. You can store your source code there, and it's all quite smoothly. So these are the three topics I want to discuss today. And I want to begin with the first topic, the source control or version control. Okay, again, Markdown. Maybe one of you can Google that and tell me the key combination. So the idea is that from time to time, you take a snapshot of your project. These snapshots are called commits. Actually, we're going to use a software called Git for version control. You take a snapshot, and then you store all the snapshots in a repository. And Git is a distributed version control system. That means you can have different copies of the repository. You can have one copy on your laptop, another copy on a workstation, a third copy on GitHub. And if you want to write a project and have me look at it, I'm going to make a copy of the whole repository, and thus I can see all the differences. And it is distributed. Multiple copies of repository. And the idea is also that you can push and pull things between repositories. And push and pull commits between posit. Yeah, now I need to type here between repositories. And Git is really powerful. There's a command line interface that Linux experts like to use. I'm going to show you a graphical user interface that is much less confusing and that is easier to use. And what we are going to do in the first half hour of this session is you're going to download a particular software that is produced by GitHub called GitHub Desktop, I believe. You're going to install that on your laptop. And using this GitHub laptop, you're going to convert the example project that we created so far, in my case, the example 2018, into a repository by adding the respective bits. And then you're going to publish that repository onto GitHub for everybody to see. And then whenever you make changes, you can push and pull between these repositories. Yes?
I'm still locked out of GitHub.
Okay. You can talk to me after the lecture, and then we can sort out how this works. Where exactly are you locked out?
I thought I created an account. It's now claiming it's done.
You mean you don't have an account on GitHub?
An email saying, hi, welcome to GitHub, or whatever. Usual welcome email.
Yes?
No, this is never
done. Okay, strange. We need to sort that out. So let's begin by downloading and installing the respective software. So let's go to GitHub. Going to switch screens now. GitHub.com. Actually, I'm just Google for GitHub Desktop, probably the easiest to do. I don't think you can see that because my browser doesn't want to make that line up here rather large. But if you look for GitHub Desktop, then you end up on a page like this one here, larger screen size. And there you can download it for macOS. If you use Windows, there should be a button for you. Download for Windows. If you're already familiar with Git or using a different client, you can do that. They all have the same basic features, probably just different colors that appear on the screen. And if you're using Linux, it's a bit more complicated. Is there anybody here using Linux not familiar with Git? Okay. There is a version of GitHub Desktop for Linux, but it's not an official distribution. Probably have to Google GitHub Desktop Linux and then follow the link. And there's another person that made a release for that that you can install that comes in terms of packages for Ubuntu and Red Hat and so on that you can install. Yes?
My problem. I have found my account and it's not giving me any way of following your call.
Pardon?
I have my account.
Very good.
Right. So it does actually exist. It's hopeless. And I cannot get anywhere near your call. Like you directly, but I'm locked out of your thing.
Okay. It's strange. Is anybody else able to see the wiki pages on GitHub? Ah, okay. Yes. When you said log out, I meant you can't even look at it. But if you can read it, then I probably need to enable that. I remember you sending me your GitHub account. I need to enable so that you can edit the wiki. Okay. Can you download the desktop GitHub software and install it on your laptop? And after you did this and started, then the user interface, well, for me, it looks approximately like this. Yes. I didn't think of it, but apparently I can't really change the font size here. So going to have to, there's something I can do. No, I don't think I can do anything.
Just making it bigger?
No, I don't know how to make it bigger. The usual key combinations don't work. And I can zoom in on my screen, but as we found out yesterday, it does not work out on that screen. Okay. As you're downloading this, who is currently downloading GitHub Desktop? You're all downloading it. Very good. And then after downloading, I want you to start it. And it's probably going to ask you for questions about your GitHub username and your account name because it wants to be able to access your GitHub account so that it can create repositories there and access it, push and pull. So please enter the respective credentials. At the moment, we're just going to wait until you've installed the software.
Well, right now, I can't find it.
So if you're using Linux, let me try to find it. Desktop, Git.
Terminal online discussions about how to do it, but no.
Yes, yes. So there's a GitHub Desktop for Linux issue 1525. And if you go there, there is a pointer to the repository and an update. Have you found that as well, Beatrice? And then you go there to releases in shift keys. That's a nice user intername, repository. You see the releases, and this is probably the one you want to download. Mm. What I want to do next is help you to create a Git repository for the example that you created last time. So I'm going into this window. Unfortunately, it's a bit small. I'm going to tell you what I'm doing, but you might not be able to read it. I'm going to File and say...
Are you?
Yes?
So, in order to get into desktop, after downloading, you start this and
yes?
Ask you about an email. Is there any instruction about that?
It wants to know, it wants to connect to your GitHub account. So you would use the same email address as you use for your GitHub account on your GitHub username. You don't recall that? Okay. So whenever you create a commit in Git, it usually tags the commit with your name, with the current date, and with your email address. It kind of uses your email address as your identity so that if you look at the history of a project, you know who created what commit, who made what changes. So in your case, you can just use your parameter email address. That should be fine. Okay, yes, okay. Did you all start the GitHub desktop and entered email address and username, etc.? Nobody says anything. Who is not yet finished? Okay, there are a few people. Let's wait 20 more seconds. Are you all now seeing a window similar to this? Maybe a bit more empty because you don't have any repositories yet? Okay, let's go to File and say New Repository. You're creating a repository where you created the example 2018 project. So New Repository, and then you need to use that. It says here, Local Path. There's an option, Choose. You choose. And then you go to the place where the example 2018 directory is. Don't go into the 2018 directory, just go where the directory is. Sorry, I can't make this larger either. Then, in my case on Mac, I choose Open, and then I need to choose a name for the repository, and the name for the repository should better be the same as the name of the project. So I'm typing example 2018 here. If you gave your project a different name, then you would choose a different name here. Example 2018. And then there are a few other choices you can make. You can give a description to the repository. That's kind of a one-line tagline. I'll just rewrite something here. Example project for comp first course. And then there's a button down here, initialize this repository with a README. That's a good idea. That is then nicely displayed on the GitHub page. And it says git ignore none. I'm going to use Julia here. And it says license, and I'll choose the Apache license. It's a well-known open source license that has protections against the software patents. So if someone were to use my project, they can't sue me for infringing on software patents. Seems like a good idea. And then once you've made all these changes, I click on Create Repository.
That's git ignore?
Pardon?
Is git ignore?
Oh, git ignore. The snapshots you want to take should probably not contain all the files that you have on disk. For example, there might be some editor backup files, some temporary files, some output, etc. Some craft that is generated that you usually don't even look at. And git ignores these files by default, then they are not stored in the Git repository. And by using Julia here, GitHub has settings that it knows what typical garbage files are created in Julia that should be ignored. So if you don't do the git ignore, it doesn't matter. If you don't choose a license, doesn't matter either. It just means nobody else can use your code without personally asking you first. And if you leave out the description, you can edit the description later. The only important field here is the name of the project, which I call example 2018. Actually, there's a convention. I think Julia projects usually have .jl in the end. And yeah, let's not do that. Who knows? So I'm clicking create repository now. And then the window looks approximately as before, but it now says current repository. What is this? What is this? It says current repository 2018C. I want 2018 here. What happened? Uh-oh, does it work for you? But not for me? Okay, let me just quit that thing. GitHub desktop started again. I hope it looks better now. Uh-oh. Well, it's good that it worked for you. Sorry. EWD, LS. Yes, no, it created, it worked for me, but apparently can't find remove example 2018A.
Why do you have a C?
A C at the end?
You have example 2018C. Why is there a C?
There should not be a C, but that's the problem. I think it should be 2018 and not 2018C. Did I type C accidentally?
Probably.
Sorry, let me fix my laptop here. I'm going to look at the internals of what happens here. No, description. No, it seems all right. It's just that GitHub desktop is confused. Okay, I'm going to go to add local repository and maybe it finds it then. Okay, this is correct now. I'm now in the current repository. I don't know what happened here. It's good that you don't have this problem. And there's a tab history. If you choose history, you see the history of the project and the history of all the commits that were previously made. At the moment, there should be just one commit, namely the initial snapshot that GitHub took automatically for your project. And there you see all the files that are there. There's the files that I created, the source code and the run tests file. I know you can't really see that. And there's also the license file and the README that was added. So far, you don't see any changes, but what we can do now, we can take this project and push it onto GitHub. We can publish it there. And the way to do there should be a button at the very top. For me, it's this button, if you see it. And it says, publish this repository to GitHub. I'm going to push the button. Then it asked me a few questions. Keep this code private? No, I want to keep the code public. If you keep your code private and want to host it on GitHub, you have to pay for it. Unless you have already uploaded your, told them about your credit card, it won't let you do that. This is probably just asking for money. If you make the code public, you can have it hosted for free. That's what we're going to do during this course. And you can also choose a particular organization. I'm not going to choose any organization. Organization is where you can manage your repositories on GitHub. No organization is just fine. I'm going to publish the repository. And it should take a few seconds. And then I'm going to switch to my GitHub web, GitHub here, yes. You should be able to read this now. This is now a bit larger. Make it a bit larger. And I'm going to my list of repositories. And there, this repository should have shown up. And if you do the same in your web browser, you should be able to see your repository there. Okay, let me go back to GitHub desktop. Were you able to follow the instructions there to create the repository, create the initial commit, and then publish your repository? Who has not yet done that? Okay, let me try to fix that. Okay, there are two things I want to say. First, if you so want, today's lecture or today's lab is probably the most important one in the whole course. Because if you don't want to learn Julia, and if you decide you're not interested in computational physics at all, the thing that I'm discussing today about version control and test cases and so on, that applies to all software engineering and all projects. So I am using GitHub and similar things, not just for source code, also for LaTeX, for papers I'm writing, and for proposals I'm writing, and so on. So this is really useful, and the features that you take snapshots, and you can go back in time to see what happened earlier, that I'm going to demonstrate later. This is actually quite useful and really important. Having said that, the second thing I wanted to say is, what I expected to happen is that you still have the Julia package example 2018, or whatever you called it, from last Friday session. I now realize that some of you deleted that because maybe you didn't like it, or you, anyway, you did not create a Git repository onto that package. You created an empty Git repository that has no Julia code in there. And this will not do for today's lecture. So I'm going to have to improvise a bit. And what you can do instead of creating your own repository, you can clone my package, my repository that I just created. It's also a very nice feature of Git, that you can clone someone else's repository if it's public and can then work with it. And if you do that, then you don't need to worry if your old Julia code didn't work out, or if you deleted it, or if you did something wrong. Yes, you had a question?
It was just that I didn't code, but I still did. There wasn't any code in mine.
There's no code in there? Did you go into the wrong directory maybe?
I think so.
Okay, let me just check it.
Ah, you were in the wrong directory. Yes.
Sorry. As usual, computers are very iffy about the tiniest detail. And what I suggested, when you create a directory, you need to be one directory above the Julia directory. So your Git directory was created within the project. So you were probably one directory too low. If you had got up one directory, it would have worked. Anyway, what I want to show you now is how you can actually use my project, the thing that I created last Friday. You can download it, and then we can continue from there doing things. You can make changes and add test cases and so on. So what I want you to do, and that's actually something slightly different from what I just explained to someone from you, you can go to my project. And so you go to your web browser, you open my project on GitHub, that is this page here, it says Ishnet example 2018. And then here's a green button where it says clone or download. No, sorry, wrong button up here. Yes, it's this button here where it says fork. Fork means like a fork in the path, means that you kind of make your own copy of my project. Then you have an independent project that starts out with my project, but you can from then on make your own independent changes. So you would click on that fork button here. Can you do this?
Can you look in the name of the...
It's called example 2018 on GitHub Ishnet.
Search for Ishnet.
Yes, so you can either type Ishnet example 2018 up here, or search or jump to, you look for Ishnet or for example 2018. On GitHub. Yeah, I cannot really show that because I can't really make a fork of my repository, I think. So there's something that I can't show you. I did not foresee that. Sorry.
So, as a fork, we can only change and commit to.
If you make a fork, then you take my repository on GitHub and you copy it, and that copy then is your repository on GitHub. It just starts out with whatever I have there, what I have just created, and your copy is then completely independent. You can do whatever you want. And since I chose the Apache license, it's also legal, and then you don't have to care about anything.
And then we need to clone it.
And then you need to clone it locally so that it ends up on your laptop. And then you can make changes. When you use Julia, you activate the project, you run the test cases, etc. So did you create a fork? I think you might also be able to rename it as you fork it. Who has created a fork of the repository? Okay, it's 3 out of 15 or something. Are you still working on creating a fork of the repository? Or
there are 12 now.
There are 12.
Oh, wow. Yes. There you go. Okay. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24. Okay. There should be 24. There are only 12.
Where do we find your example 2018? Is it on?
You go on GitHub.
Yeah.
You need to be logged into GitHub. And then you there's a search bar somewhere where you look for ESHnet or for example 2018 here.
Search for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the top right corner is the fork button. 13 by now, very good. So if you clone the repository, and if you already had a local directory with the same name, then by default, the clone will receive a new name. It will be -1 or -2 in the end. So don't be confused about that. What I want you to do now is go to Julia, open the Julia command line, and activate the newly cloned project. And in my case, of course, it's simple because I'm already here. So I'm in this particular directory where the project is, and I can just say activate and run the tests. And you need to find out what the exactly name and path to the project is that you just cloned. And you need to make sure that you have the -1 or -2 in the end if there was a naming conflict. And then you can, no, what is this? Okay, you are going to all see the same error. You're all going to have to fix that. Because you cloned something with a problem. Okay, and very proudly, you also figured out to get larger letters in Emacs, so that's good for me. So where was that in what line? Fail to pre-compile, where's the line number? 52. 52. Yes. Did you see the change I made? It was space dot star, and they needed to change it to base dot space star. Okay, who has activated and run tests and seen that error message? Same as last Friday, you need to open a terminal, you need to cd into the directory where you downloaded the repository and start Julia there. So first you clone the repository, and then you start Julia the same way we did last Friday. So the error is in here, the error message says it's in line 52. And in line 52, it says base space dot star, and it should be base dot space star. So you need to move the dot to the left, and then it should work.
Can you say?
Yes. On GitHub, on the website, you click clone or download, and then there's a button open in desktop that you hit, and this will then in desktop allow you to clone the project. And you should probably remember where it is, so you can go to GitHub desktop and find out where it is on disk. Okay. Pardon? First you open a terminal window, a shell, and then you run Julia there. On the other hand, on Windows, there's probably also a graphical thing that you can click and start Julia. And then within Julia, you have to use the cd command to go to a particular directory. Okay. Okay, let me briefly repeat what the actual error is. The error is in line 52, that's indicated by the error message. And the error is that there's a space after base here, where the cursor is, and then dot star. But dot star cannot be together. There needs to be a space between the dot star. So I typed space dot instead of dot space. And I can correct that. And now I'm going to rerun the tests, and that should work now. Yay! And then as a next step, just to keep you on your toes, I'm going to the GitHub desktop, and there it shows, you know, the changes I made since the previous commit. And that is quite nifty that you see what changes you made since the last commit. So this helps you not accidentally making any changes, or you're able to undo the changes if you want, if you didn't want to make them. I'm going to say that again, don't worry, because none of you is listening. Okay, who has seen the error message by now? Okay, it seems to me that you have all seen the error message, that you have all opened the editor, you have corrected it, you have rerun the tests, and then you can peek on GitHub Desktop where it shows the changes. And then I want you to make a new commit, take a new snapshot. So for this, you need to enter a summary for the commit. Each commit needs to be associated with the commit message. It will also record the time and the date, the name of your computer, your email address, and so on. And I just say here, correct syntax error. That's where it's a summary if you can't see it. Then there's a blue button that turns from light blue to dark blue after you enter the summary. It says commit to master. I click that button. And then there's a button up there in the top right in the window where it changes from fetch to push to origin. And there's a little one somewhere. And that means there's one new commit that you can push to your GitHub repository. So you have two copies of the repository, right? One is on your laptop, and the one is on that web service on GitHub, and you're going to push that commit over. So I'm going to click that, pushing to origin, hang on, blah, blah, 100%, and we are done. And if you then go to your GitHub repository and look at it, then it should say two commits here, and you can look at the history and so on and see all the changes.
Where does it say two commits?
You might need to reload the page. It says two commits here.
First one.
Yeah, thanks.
So after you push, there should be two. And of course, if you go to really old projects, this says something like 14,000 commits there. And you know, there are hundreds of people who collaborated. You can go to the Julia websites. I mean, the Julia project itself uses GitHub, and you can look at it and see how many commits they actually have. It's amazing. This thing scales to many collaborators, to planet-wide collaborations. Okay, let's continue. Who has pushed the changes to GitHub in the meantime? I think there's almost all of you. Very good. If that is working, I want to move on to the second topic of today. I mean, obviously, Git is a vast topic. There are many more things you can do with it, and there are beautiful tutorials available online, and I'm sure we're going to talk it in the remainder of the course in other lab sessions. But for today, I think that's good enough. I want to move on to the second topic. The second topic was test cases. So again, markdown, test cases. The idea is that if you have a piece of software and you've written it, then the piece of software that you wrote needs to have certain properties, and you want to make it has certain properties. You want to run tests that it is correct. Tests in software engineering is probably comparable to what would be a proof for a mathematician. In software engineering, things are more complicated. It's very difficult to prove correctness, so you can only test it. But if you've written a function and you hit it with tests, then it's less and less likely that the errors in there, if the tests are well designed, if you have enough tests. And similar with proofs in mathematics, if you have a theorem, you don't necessarily need to prove it yourself. It's good enough if someone else proved it and you believe it then. If you want to use a particular software project that someone else has written, and if they have good test cases, that is kind of the equivalent of proof. It's, of course, not the same thing, because tests can never be as good as a proof, but it's the same idea behind it. You want to have not just intuition, but you want to have something tangible to see whether something is correct or not. Now, Julia has testing and so on built in, and we have used this file test/run tests, but we've abused it. We've not actually put any tests in there. The only thing that we have put in there are certain commands to show some output. I want to make that more structured, and we're going to actually put test cases in there. There's a particular software development style. It's called test-driven development, TDD. And in test-driven development, you don't write the software first and then you sprinkle tests over it until your boss tells you it's good enough. Instead, you require certain functionality, then you write the tests for that functionality. Of course, the tests are all going to fail because you didn't implement anything. And then you write your functions until all the tests pass. And then you're done. Then you stop developing. Because it doesn't make sense to make a change to the code if it's not covered by a test, because you wouldn't know whether it's correct or not. And as example, I want to take the polynomials that we wrote last time. It's incidentally in that example 2018 case. And polynomials are interesting. Well, they're not interesting because they contain a list of coefficients or something. But mathematically, polynomial might be interesting, for example, because they form a ring. You can add them, multiply them, and so on. And as a ring, they have certain properties. Addition is associative, there's a neutral element, there's an inverse element, and multiplication, I don't know, but probably associative, commutative, and so on. And this is the thing that we're going to test for polynomials. And note that these properties are independent of our internal representation. We represented polynomials as a list of coefficients. There are other ways to represent them. We could just list the zeros that they have, fundamental theorem of algebra. Or instead of the list of coefficients, there's another scheme called the Horner scheme that is actually computationally more efficient to represent polynomials. But that's not the point here. The point is that you have different internal ways of representing the same polynomial. And it doesn't really matter what representation you choose, because what's interesting about the polynomial is the laws they obey, the axioms that they fulfill. It's not the internal representation that you choose, for us, a vector of coefficients. So let me go to the source code in the tests directory. And you all have this file. Oh, that should be larger. Oh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is that large enough? Can you see that? Very good. I'm going to delete all this because we don't need it. And why don't we need it? Because I took a snapshot and the snapshot was a GitHub. So if I accidentally delete something, I can just go there and copy and paste and put it back or something similar. And I'm now going to write down what we want to test. Polynomials form a ring. And what is it? What properties does a ring have? Addition is associative. These are just Julia comments that are writing here. There is a additive identity, additive inverse, addition commutes. I'm just writing properties that it should have. Multiplication is... Well, I don't want to write anything about multiplication because, as it turns out, what we actually implemented for polynomials is nothing about multiplication. We had a scalar multiplication to scale a polynomial, but we don't actually have code to multiply polynomials. We could add that. I'm not going to do that. That's not the point of the lecture. I'm just writing down these properties here. So what I'm going to do now, and what I'm going to do with you, is write respective test cases. Julia has a particular command where you can test something and the test either succeeds or it fails. And then when you run the test command, what you did, it gives you a nice summary of what succeeded and what fails. For example, let's write two basic tests. One equals zero and another test, one equals one. And now I'm going to run the test cases again. And I get an error message, at test is not defined, right? This is defined in a module called test. So I need to say using test first. Let's begin. Can you all read the screen? Does that work for you? Did I make it larger? Okay, let's run test again. Package test not found. Okay, I need to go to the package manager and add the test package and run it again. And then I see the beautiful screen output. One of the tests failed. One is not equals to zero. Obviously, right, that's why I wrote the test, because it didn't fail. And then no statistics? No nice statistics. OK. Yes?
We didn't use at test, did we?
I just did it up. Yes, because previously we didn't use that macro. There's this at test. Previously, we just wrote at show to show something to the screen. But that just means we need to look at it every time. And with our test, Julia actually does the testing.
So where should we be when we tell to test?
You What you need to do is you need to activate the project, and then you need to be in package manager mode and run the test command. It's the same way we ran the test command last Friday. 1 = 2, man, I have 2 failing tests. Okay, let me correct both tests and run it again. And then I want to see no statistics. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I need to introduce another feature before we see statistics. But it says here, tests passed. So that the 2 tests passed. Sorry, I made a change afterward. Let me undo that. Yes. Yes. To fix that, I said using test in the module. That's the first line that I added. You need to do that.
Just using test?
Just using test, yes. The way I wrote it up there. That's it.
Eric?
Yes?
Is there a way to have, like, you put 1 = 0 and 2 = 2, and it gives you that at least 1 of the 2 is correct? Looking at the second one.
Oh, it's actually looking at all the tests, and I don't know. No, what it did, it complained about the first test, and the second test, I don't know.
It's not looking at it because it's
really. No, it should. It should.
I tried 1 = 0 and 1 = 1, and saying
it didn't say anything. Okay. Yes. In a minute, I'm going to introduce another feature called test sets, and then it's actually going to look at anything. Yeah. Yes? What error is it now? And you have using test. Did you save it? Maybe you forgot to save it?
Yeah, no, I did that.
Yes, yes, good point. Can I see the error message?
Oh, okay.
I think she added the using test to the wrong file. Okay. So, did you all add a test like that? And did it work for you? All the tests passed? I mean, these are just trivial tests, right? These are not the good ones.
What is test with a capital T?
Pardon? That is a module, and that module implements nice functions and macros for testing. For example, the add test macro. It comes with Julia, it's built in. It's a module, but you don't need to download it. It is part of the standard library. Okay. So let me now write a more interesting test. Let me now write a test that actually has to do something with polynomials. What should we do? What can we do? Associative is kind of complicated because of 3 terms or something. Let's check that there's an additive identity, right? Let's define z equals polynomial 0. That's a 0 polynomial. And that's some random polynomial p equals 1, 2, 3, and then p plus z equals p. And let's see whether that works. Oh, wow. Yes. So what Julia, no, this is a shortcut I took yesterday. In my mind, it worked beautifully. Apologies for these kind of dirty lectures where you're getting sidetracked all the time. What Julia now claims is that these polynomials are not identical because this has floating point numbers and this has integers. And therefore, they are not identical. But of course, if you were to convey the integers to floating point numbers or vice versa, they would be identical. So now we need to fix the add routine. That was a shortcut I took on Wednesday regarding addition, where the addition always returns floating point numbers instead of returning the same type that it should. So I'm going to fix that. So I'm going to the add routine. And I'm going to modify it. Oof. Sorry, I need to test it. Zeros, int, comma, four. Yes. Zeros, type of L type p.coefs. Let me see whether that works. What? I'm puzzled. Do you see a difference? Oh, that I did this much more fundamental, the error that I made. Now, I meant to introduce that before I showed you the test cases. The thing is that we did not define a comparison function for polynomials. Julia does not know how to compare polynomials to see whether they're equal or not. And thus the default is that things are not equal, because if you compare the two things and it doesn't know anything, apparently it just says they're not equal. So if you compare a number and a string, Julia would say they're not equal. So what we need to do, we need to introduce a function to compare polynomials. And there are two ways of doing that. One way would be, it works in algebra if you want to compare two things, if you subtract them from each other and then check whether the result is zero. And if the result is negative or positive, would be larger or smaller. That's a common trick. It's also how computers compare numbers all the time. The comparison is essentially a subtraction, and in the end, you check whether the result is zero or you check the sign of the result. And of course, the other way to do that would be explicitly implemented, like adding things, you compare each coefficient one after the other. That's a bit more tedious. So I suggest we implemented the simple way where we just subtract two polynomials and then check whether the result is actually the zero polynomial. So I'm going to provide the corresponding function, base.equals. And then you take the difference, d equals p minus q, because we already implemented on Wednesday in how to take the difference between polynomials, and then we check whether the coefficients of d are all zero. In mathematics, when you represent a polynomial, you usually say it needs to have the minimum possible degree, that is, the leading coefficient must be non-zero. That's not a condition we imposed. So there could be many leading zero coefficients, so we need to check that. Yes?
We define the minors. We have
You're checking. No, we did not. Thank you. Okay. Let's define minors first. I'm getting sidetracked here, but why not? Function base dot minus p polynomial, comma, q. This is actually not difficult. Actually, before we do that, sidetrack, let's define how we negate a polynomial. And this is just minus 1 times p. Because we have scalar multiplication, to negate a polynomial, we just multiply it with minus 1. And then to subtract two polynomials from each other, we add p plus minus q. And then we have subtracted them. So we did all the heavy lifting already. We just didn't actually implement that.
And does it matter that the scalar multiplication... Oh, wait, never mind. Sorry.
Yeah, we defined two ways of scalar multiplication, by left multiplication and the right multiplication. Did we actually do that? I don't. Oh no, the other one was here, right? This is the right multiplication.
So in that example, does it matter which function do you declare first, the order of?
No, that does not matter. When Julia reads a module, it reads it top to bottom and reads all the function in, and then it only looks at the functions when you actually use the functions for the first time. And by the time you use the function, Julia has read the whole module and all everything is defined.
Perfect. How does Julia know which of the two, you know, I see two functions, function base dot, then minus?
Yes, it looks at the number of arguments.
The arguments don't come when I write my text, my instruction, right? It's going to be p minus q.
Yes.
So how does it know that it's two? That there are two arguments.
Oh, if you write p minus q, then it's two arguments, the one before and the one after. And this is why I added the parenthesis here, because this is only one argument. Mm. And I could probably leave out the parentheses. I mean, it knows about the precedence rule, so it might have worked out anyway. Just for clarity, I think it's a good idea.
What did you change again in the plus function?
I did not change the plus function at all. There was the bug that we fixed earlier with the base dot star here, but you all committed that. And then what I just did just right now is these two functions.
But now you have polynomial int 64 and int 64 and float 64.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, I did change that. So this is this line here that I changed. I'm calling a function zeros. And I added as first argument the type that I want to have. And if I don't give that first argument, then apparently Julia chooses float 64. And here the thing that I added is this expression, which is I look at the coefficients of p, and then I call a function L-type. L-type is short for element type. So coefficients is an array, and this function returns the element type of the array. So if it's an array of int, the thing would be int. If it's an array of rational, that thing would return rational. And that type is then passed to zeros, so it produces an array of all zeros of the respective type. Now, let's look at the equals function here. What I now need to do, I need to look at this polynomial d, I need to check whether the coefficients are all zero. And there's probably a function called all for that that I can use. Looking at the help mode here. Yes, here's an example where it checks whether all elements are larger than zero. So I'm going to model my call here similarly. All c goes to c not equal zero, comma d coefs. No, equal zero, right? They all need to be equal to zero. And then the polynomials are equal. Good. Before we discuss the changes, I want to see whether that's actually correct, because if I made a bug, I don't want to actually explain. Yes, it is correct. Okay. So very slowly, let's go down where we added the subtraction. These are the lines that I added. The first function just negates a polynomial, that's the additive inverse. And the second function is just a convenience function where subtracting polynomials means you take the first plus minus the second. Mm. Good. Let me try to keep that on the screen here at the bottom. And then I can show the comparison function that I wrote up here at the same time. And to compare two polynomials, I subtract them from each other. I call the difference d. And then I look at the coefficients of d and check whether the coefficients are all zero. So all is a built-in function in Julia. It takes essentially an iterator and checks whether all the elements are true. So the function. First, you apply this function to the coefficients. C goes to C equals zero, so each coefficient is replaced with the result of the comparison to zero. So this is then a polynomial that consists of values like true, 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 false, true, and so on, and then all checks whether it's all true. So this returns true only if all the coefficients are actually zero. And then you can run the tests again. And if everything works, the result should be true. This is an enormous function, and if you call it with 4, then the result is 9. And anonymous functions, or lambda expressions, are very convenient in places like here. For example, you want a condition that you check whether something is 0 and c equals 0. I mean, it's just very short, compact notation. You don't need to define a function, and you don't need to introduce in Julia by as a function or check whether the array is all 0, check whether it is all non-zero, and so on. This is a nice, compact way and very compositional.
When do you do function equal 0?
What would you have said?
Oh,
yes, we could have done that as well. Yes, very good. I was so bent on introducing this notation here. What is it, d.coefs? Like this, right? There was an error, run tests 14, what is wrong? Oh. Yes. Very good. Yeah, it's a bit simpler. Let's keep that version then. Thank you.
What is the meaning of the function all?
All takes an array or an iterator of Boolean statements, of logical statements, and checks whether they're all true. So you have 3 statements, and then all of them need to be true. And the converse would be any, where at least one must be true. Good. Now we have this. Now I'm going to go back to GitHub, of course, and I'm going to look at the changes here. And I'm going to meet them. Implement subtraction and comparison. Commit to master, push to origin. And now my version is on the web. So if you now later want to check whether your version is equal to mine, you can just go to my GitHub repository and see what I have there. And it's very convenient. Also, if I make now later changes and I accidentally delete something, I can always go back and check. So here we checked whether P plus Z is equal to P. There's of course a converse test that we should also do. It also needs to be the left identity, that is trivial. I'm not even going to run it. We also need to check whether the additive inverse works, whether the subtraction works. So let me add a test for that. That was P plus minus P equals 0. And let me run the tests again. And that also worked. Now, at the moment, these tests are not very strong because I'm testing it only with a single polynomial with the coefficients 1, 2, 3, and that's not really a strong test. I want to have a really strong test. I want to test with random polynomials. I want to run the test 100 times or 1,000 times. So what I'm going to introduce now is a test set. In a test set, you can easily repeat the same test multiple times. So the command for that is at test set. Test set need to have a name. Polynomials form a ring. And then I run it 100 times. I hope I get the syntax right. For n in 1 to 100. And then end here. And this gets indented. And now, at the moment, I'm running the same test 100 times. That is boring. Let me just run that. This is not what I wanted. Let me run it like this. There you go. Now I get nice statistics. I'm having one test set where I say I'm testing whether polynomials form a ring. In this test set, I have a for loop where I just do something 100 times and I run these tests. Of course, these tests don't really test whether a polynomial is a ring, right? We're just testing some simple properties. And altogether, I'm running 300 tests and they're all passed. Of course, it's trivial, right? Because I'm using the same polynomial 100 times. That's not really interesting. So what I want to do now is invent a random polynomial. So random numbers in Julia, let's say rand 0 to 10 gives you a random number between 0 and 10. Degree is a random number between 0 and 100. And then there's also a function rand n, is it not? 10, 4. Is it just rand? Yes. If you call random with two arguments, the return value will be an array. So this gives me kind of an arbitrary polynomial. You're still typing and explaining it anyway. First, I choose the variable deg as in degree as a random number between 0 and 100. That means I want to create a polynomial of degree with some number between 0 and 100. And then I create a respective polynomial. I create an array with degree number of elements. Should be degree plus one, right? Yes, degree plus one. And each of the coefficients is in a range from minus 1,000 to 1,000. Of course, I could make it stronger, right? I probably want a million to a million or something. And then I run the respective tests. Let's see whether it still works. It still works. And I can change the loop here to a million. I can run the test a million times. Of course, still not as watertight as a mathematical proof. But if it works for random polynomials, that is already a strong statement that leaves very little wiggle room for problems in the code.
Can you get one statistic for each test?
I don't know. Probably there might be another flag that you can give to test, or you can grant more test sets if you so wanted. You can, each of these could be turned into a test set if you wanted.
But you do that job.
Yes, then you would get 300 outputs. I don't want that. Three outputs would be nice, right? Because currently I'm saying polynomials form a ring. That is kind of a wishy-washy thing. I would kind of say left neutral element, right neutral element, and additive inverse, and probably want to test commutativity as actually, yeah, as well. Okay, who is still implementing this? I see a few people typing. Very good, we obeyed. Okay. Have you all run the 300 tests and succeeded? Most people are nodding. Okay. So let me commit the changes again. Always commit. Do you have something? Test some ring properties. Commit. And push. And where are we here? If you look at commits, if you click on this button on the GitHub site, then you see a nice history of things. And you can actually browse the how the files actually looked like at each instant in time, if you want. This is, I went to the repository and there's a four commits. That is actually a link and you can go there. Okay. I promised you last Wednesday, or I threatened to you, that I was going to give homework. I'm going to give you two homeworks. First, I want you to extend the test sets. I want you to also test that polynomial addition is commutative or associative and so on. You should all be able to add that yourself. And the second homework has to do with something that I'm going to show you, but we might not be able to actually finish it in time because there's just 15 minutes left. So I'm going to show you. I want you to repeat what I did then later on at home. And the thing is, running the tests on your laptop is nice, but things would be much more stringent if GitHub were to run the tests automatically whenever you commit something. That means you have tests in your project, and whenever you or one of your collaborators makes a change to the code, all the tests are automatically rerun. If anything breaks, you get sent an email, and there's a nice badge on the repository that is green if all the tests failed, and if all the tests succeed, and red if it fails. And if you go to other open source projects, you see these things. And if you see, oh, the last commit was made 2 years ago and all the tests are failing, then you say, maybe I'll use a different one. And there are these really active projects where the last commit happened last week and all the tests are green and so on. And then you know, I might look into that. I might use that project for my work. This seems like a project that's an active community and they care about things, and this is reliable enough. So I'm going to show you how to make GitHub run the tests automatically. It's not actually GitHub doing that. It's other companies offering that service. As usual, if you want to use that service as a company, you have to pay for it. For an open source project, it's free. And the particular service that I'm going to use is called Travis. So I'm going to, which happens to be a German company, has nothing to do with it. There are other companies to do that as well. So let's go to the website, travis-ci.org. Now I'm going to have to speed up a bit because I want to finish this in the next 10 minutes. So you might not all be able to finish all the way through. But let's go to travisci.org. You're going to have to create an account, log in, maybe connect to your GitHub account and so on. And what I want to do now is I want to tell Travis about the new repository that we just created so that Travis will begin testing it. So I click on the plus button. Do you see? Screen not large enough. Where is it here? Can you see it? Pull request. Make it smaller. It's scrolled down a bit here. There's a thing called My Repositories. I'm using Travis for many, many repositories, right? So my screen is really busy. Yours will not be. And there's a little plus sign hiding, and I'm clicking on the plus sign. And then it lists all the repositories that Travis currently knows about. And this is quite a bit. And actually, it's three more pages like that. And the first thing I'm going to do is, what is it? There's a particular button I have to press. Oh, sync account is this button. I want Travis to look at all the repositories I currently have on GitHub so that it sees the new repository I just created. Now, you don't need to remember that, right? There are lots of blog posts and videos that explain you how to do that. You can just follow that. At the moment, I just want you to lean back and follow on. Sync account, did anything happen? Let's try again. Nothing happens. Let's try again. Syncing, very good. And then the list on the right here, previously it did not say anything. It's a bit small, let me make it larger. Did not say anything about example 2018. Something should show up. Still syncing. Apparently I have too many repositories. Yeah, come on, I'm bored now. There you go. And if I scroll down a bit, then here, what? I called it example, right? EX, what? Okay, filter repositories, example. There you go. And there's a nice bar and I can click it. And now the repository is active. Now Travis told GitHub, whenever there's a change to my repository, GitHub will send Travis a message, and Travis can then look at the repository and build it. Hmm. There are some settings. Are these interesting? Nah, it's not interesting. And if I click on the respective thing, it says no builds for repository, because what I need to do now, I need to write a little script that tells Travis how to actually build the project. It's a bit of a black art, and I'm usually just take another project and copy the respective Travis script. So let me go to GitHub. And I have a particular project here called Arbitrary. And I'm going to look at that. And this Arbitrary project has a particular Travis file here. It's called .travis.yaml. As usual, all the dots and the spelling and upper and lowercase is extremely important. You need to get this all correct. Oh, by the way, you remember when you generate a Julia project, how you need to create the test, run tests manually? I suggested to the maintainer that that should happen automatically. And he or she, probably he, said it's already implemented, not yet in the published version. And he also, and then I saw a Git file in there as well. He sent me a screenshot about what is automatically done. And then I said, well, does it even automatically create a Git repository? And he said, yes. So that means in the future, I don't know, a month or two from now, when you use generate in Julia, it creates a Git repository, it creates a Travis file like that, and it does all these things automatically that you now have to do manually. So I'm taking this Travis file here from the other project, and I just look at it on GitHub, 17 lines. Yeah, it's difficult to write, don't care. I'm just going to copy it, yeah, if that works. And then I'm going to put it into my project folder here. The name needs to be exact. What is it now? There. Yeah. And need to make that a bit larger again. Can you read that? Let's do one more. And the thing is, the project name appears in this Travis file. So I actually need to replace the arbitrary here with something else. What is it? It appears several times. So using search and replace. Deleted here. All the red things here are comments. You can ignore that. So essentially what I'm telling Travis, the language is Julia. I want to test it on Linux and on Mac OS. Travis does not support testing on Windows. There's another service called AppWare that allows you to test on Windows. I'm going to test the three different versions of Julia, not the one I've installed. 0.7, 1.0, and the nightly snapshots of the development version. And yeah, I actually don't want to get any emails from Travis, but you could enable that if you want. And then the script here is already the default script because Travis already knows about Julia. So it's all commented out. You can uncomment and make changes if you want to have particular build rules. You don't need to do that. Now let me go back to my GitHub desktop. There's a new file. I'm going to commit it. Write the summary here, add Travis support. And of course, later, you all see this in my project on GitHub, so you can look at all the details. I'm committed to master and push the changes. And now I go here to the Travis page. And I hope in a few seconds from now, unless I made a typo somewhere, this, yes, Travis picked up, there was a change. And it started to build some, let me make it smaller. Here you see. So it is currently building six different versions of my project, three for Linux, three for macOS, for the different Julia versions. I mean, for the example project, total overkill. But if you have a more complicated project and you're worried it might not work on some operating system, that's quite nice. Okay, apparently the Linux builds with the little penguins up here. These are penguins, you can't see it from the back. They're already running. The little apples here, they're not running. The macOS builds are always a bit slower on Travis. And I don't know why it takes so long. Oh no, two of them are already finished. You see the green check marks, the tests all passed. And if you want, you can even look at the output. And
tests that you have in your test folder.
Yes, it runs exactly these tests. And you can look at the output, and yeah, I don't know what happened now. Sorry, I got confused here. Let's look at the output again. Example must. Something's not working here. I just want to look at the output of the test. Okay. Anyway, if you click here, and it usually works, you see the actual output, the screen output from all the tests. You see what succeeded, what failed, and so on. And what it actually does, it goes to Amazon and somewhere, it starts a virtual machine, it installs Julia, it downloads my package, it runs the package, and so on. So you can, it's quite convenient what it does. Okay, so all the tests here succeeded, the Linux tests, and the first macOS test succeeded as well. Now the most important part, sorry, just eye candy, is you can add a badge, do you read me? By automatically, the Travis state is here, build unknown. You go to options for this. No, what is it? I don't always remember how to find my way around. Is it here, this one here? Here, if you click on the build unknown thingy up there, that should change to all green once it's succeeded. And then you get a status image. It is an image URL. I want it in Markdown. Then I click here. I copy this. And then I go to the README file in my repository. And add that thing here. And actually, I want to add more text here. This is an example project. This is just the README that appears on the GitHub webpage. And now I need to go to my GitHub desktop, add Travis badge, I commit it, and I push it. And where is it here? And I reload, don't print it, reload. And then here I have the green badge, builds passing. And if there's a test that doesn't pass and I commit something, it's all red. And other things you can do, you could another badge for AppWare. You can also have test the coverage. That's also important. That's another service you can do that checks which lines of your project are actually tested and which lines are never executed during a test. For example, we have a function to calculate a derivative, no tests for that. So that would then be flagged. And of course you have tests for the derivative function, right? Derivatives, they distribute over addition. There's a product rule. It's linear, so scalar multiplication can be pulled out, and you can add all tests for that and so on, which we didn't do. So as homework, I want you to do two things. I want you to add more tests just so that you're familiar with the tests, and I want you to have such a badge on your project. Yes?
You have to do if you want to run the tests on Windows.
Yes, there is another service I recommend, AppWare. And the easiest way to go to my arbitrary package here. And then you see an AppWare fail here. AppWare like conveyor belt, like app, like application. And of course, you need to go to the website appware.com, ask for an account there, and so on. But it's also free. And then this is the configuration file you have to use. And you don't need to make any changes here. So the AppWare configuration file does not have the project name somewhere in there. But for Travis, you need to modify the script.
What's it called, sorry?
The project that I have is called Arbitrary.
No, what is the thing for Windows?
Oh, so this is, you see it in the file name here. The one down here is AppWare. Can you read that? Okay. Maybe too small. I'll make it larger. And Travis is the one up there. And if you're taking the course for credit, or if you're interested in learning more, then I'm also expecting you to create an open source project. You can't just start with a copy of mine. You have to do some project of your own. And it has to do something in Julia, has to do something interesting. And I expect you to have a GitHub repository with test cases, with a nice README, maybe a screenshot on the README, and support for either Travis or Bayer, depending on what you want, to make sure that your project is actually nice. I'm sorry that we had to go through a bit fast to the Travis thing, but I'm sure you can do this on your own at home. As I mentioned, there are many tutorials on the web that help you out there. Mm. You have other questions to what we discussed today?
Travis.
Apparently not. I'll wait for a few more minutes for things to sink in, I guess. You cloned it? Mm.
Well, sorry, I forked it and then I cloned it.
Do you fork it again or is it the one you did earlier? Oh, you just had git test. What is that? That doesn't work.
Oh, yes, right. That but I typed it, usually.
Oh, you need to go into it. When you clone it, you end up one directory out and you do cd into it and then. And now git status should do something.
Why did I not have this one automatically get
that? No. Maybe git activate does something? Oh, the project might have been modified when you add the test module, because this is stored in project and so on, but the dependencies of the project.
Can you clone or download a file?
I would just use copy and paste like I did. So no, you cannot clone a single file. You have to clone the whole repository and look at the file and delete it again. Hmm.